I think what I'm going to say will actually fit in with what we just heard, and we'll see if this works. We've got my advertisement over. Let me go on to what I'm supposed to talk about. I'm going to describe for you sort of the framework within which we use epidemiological evidence, often in evidence-based processes, and how across that process there are a range of points where criticisms may be advanced by critics who are stakeholders in the ultimate decision. And what I'm going to describe for you is comes out of my own experience, and I think watching policy-making processes that use epidemiological evidence over the years. Now, here is a scheme that I use to torture students when they're presenting their doctoral thesis proposals, and I asked them the well so what question, which was posed to me years ago by a colleague in New Mexico who said to me, she said, well, is this one of those well so what studies? And I scratched my head and said, you know, one of those studies when you finish it, you'll say, well, so what? And as we just heard, we're doing epidemiologic research because we hope in the end there's one or more stakeholder groups who will use the evidence to advance public health. And if we've done a study that doesn't pass the well so what test, somewhere down the line in this scheme, we may find that in fact there is no policy utilization apparatus that really cares about what we have found. So there's a long course from having a scientific hypothesis, carrying out a study, publishing results, and then seeing the results utilized, perhaps cranked into a systematic review of study number 17. There your study will be in a table, or perhaps you will have a single more significant study that happens to some of us sometimes. We get more than perhaps a small delta of evidence from years of work. Now, how do we use evidence to make decisions? This is a book that actually doesn't exist, although maybe it should. Now, the process, in a very simplistic way that might involve utilization of data to make evidence-based decisions, is shown here. We carry out studies that generate data from which we hope to glean evidence on associations. We synthesize evidence using one or more processes. One process is for somebody to sit down and read a lot of papers. Another is to assemble an expert panel. Another is to use a systematic review process, perhaps carrying out a quantitative meta-analysis, or even doing what I would call a pooled analysis, gathering data at the individual level. We evaluate the evidence that we pull together using perhaps the causal criteria that have been proposed by Hill's 64 Surgeon General's report and elsewhere. We use expert judgment. I'm sure many of you have sat around tables drinking coffee and making expert panel decisions. And the good thing about those exercises is you have to come to a decision or else you don't get to go home. So sometime over the course of 2 days, stuck away in a hotel room, hotel somewhere, you make expert panel decisions. And you perhaps come up with things like the evidence sufficient, insufficient, or every epidemiologist's favorite, more research is needed, send money, please. We use words like weight of evidence to describe how we synthesize. Coming out of that, we may take a decision. The evidence is sufficient to infer causality. The evidence is sufficient to infer that trans fats adversely affect cardiovascular health, and levels should be reduced in foods, and food should be labeled. And then from that follows some action. So this is a very general linear scheme that sort of represents what happens in terms of evidence utilization. And of course, it's iterative and there are arrows going back and forth. But here's an idea I just want to leave you with, because I'm going to show how within this framework then, there are points where epidemiological evidence of use will inevitably be questioned. So here are those points where we might start at the top. Epidemiology is useless, it's junk science. The data are of inadequate quality. Biases and values are insurmountable under any circumstances, and even though you've done your best to control for all the confounders, there's either the possibility of residual confounding, or even worse, there's some confounder out there that you should have controlled for, but you didn't even know it existed. This is an argument I refer to as the unknown confounder argument that is hard to beat. What can you say? Maybe there is a confounder out there that is yet to be discovered, but so what? Flawed methods. So we just heard praise of systematic reviews and perhaps quantitative meta-analysis. But there are those who would say, particularly for observational data, garbage in, garbage out. And there are a few people whose, important people whose points of view on this matter have been pretty immutable over the last approximately 20 years while we've been carrying out these pooling exercises. The methods for evaluating evidence may be criticized. The causal criteria are not objectified. They are subject to the opinion of experts. They are not necessarily repeatable. And are experts truly neutral, or do we all come with our points of views and do we evaluate evidence with the neutrality that some think we don't have? And then on matters such as causation, again, can epidemiologic evidence establish causation or not? So to criticize epidemiologic study, you need to do no more than take an Epi 1 course or equivalent and then sort of turn everything around. So how do you deal, in fact, with chance? Well, to have a powerful study, you put evidence together. To have a less powerful study, you just stratify it for whatever association you're interested in is no longer statistically significant. Misclassification, inevitably there, and perhaps its consequences have been to mislead the epidemiologist. Selection bias, perhaps one of the most poorly understood forms of bias, can always be conjured up as an unknown and lingering factor. And confounding is a favorite of critics because, of course, there may be a suite of relevant confounders depending on the outcome. And although criteria for true confounding may not be met, it is always possible to raise the possibility of confounding. And since most people don't really understand it anyway, it's an effective argument in many of these expert panel settings. And then cause. Criteria cannot be met. Or they are not met. And if you've never had the experience of trying to line up evidence against perhaps Bradford Hill's criteria, it's an interesting exercise to have a panel do so and realize just how challenging it is and how reluctant a group of experts really are to sit, line up the evidence, and then write down sufficient, suggestive, inadequate, or perhaps suggestive of association. That's something, not something we like to do. Now, what I'm going to do is show you one example of these points of criticism of epidemiology, and one where, over the last 20 years approximately, or more, there has been substantial criticism of the evidence on passive smoking and disease, and I'm going to use the example of passive smoking and lung cancer in particular. Now, here is my scheme I showed you before. The smoking and lung cancer coming from epidemiological studies, toxicologic studies, and clearly the evidence on active smoking provided some prior basis for being concerned that exposure to secondhand smoke might cause lung cancer. One important body of epidemiological evidence was on smoking by spouses at risk for lung cancer in their smokers. The technique of meta-analysis has long been applied to this data. Right now, the pooled estimate from probably over 50 studies at this point, somewhere around 1.2. The conclusion, based on expert evaluation, the evidence has been that passive smoking gives rise to some cause of lung cancer. And of course, the actions that have followed have been to reduce passive smoking with diverse policy and educational interventions. Now, just to show you how the points of criticism that I showed you generically have been played out, certainly in this instance we've seen attempts to suggest that epidemiology may not be useful for studying this or other so-called weak associations, and that confounding and misclassification are substantial concerns. You've probably all heard of junk science, a term that sometimes arises in relationship to epidemiology. This book probably gave rise to junk science in a formal way most early, written by Peter Huber at the Manhattan Institute, a lawyer. Junk science, the mirror image of real sciences with much of the same form, but none of the same substance. And there are many who dismiss epidemiology as a soft science as opposed to a hard science, which I construe as one which involves using a water faucet. You can't use a water faucet in epidemiology. But in any case, this book is important, and there are entities out there that have the purpose of suggesting that epidemiology is junk science. Here's the junk science website. Myself and others are regular features on the junk science website. And not surprisingly, as the tobacco industry documents have been reviewed, links have been shown of the industry to supporting this website. And other efforts to suggest that epidemiology may not be adequate. Here's the confounding argument. In a letter to the New England Journal in 1990, Ragnar Rylander brought up the possibility that exposure to environmental tobacco smoke, secondhand smoke, may be confounded. A reasonable suggestion. And in fact, an editorial by Marcia Angel appeared at the same issue, pointing out that confounding and methodological issues are of concern in looking at so-called weak associations. All reasonable, but what was not revealed was Ragnar Rylander's long-standing connections to the tobacco industry. So here was a link in which he was attacking the method without showing his own interests in the matter. In terms of the criticism of epidemiological studies, Hirayama's 1981 publication, one of the first to show that passive smoking increased lung cancer risk, is a textbook. If you read the British Medical Journal over the year following, letters to the editor were written that essentially cover the gamut of EPI-1 criticisms of epidemiological studies. It's a useful teaching exercise to go through letters where the issues of confounding and misclassification were raised. There's some rather difficult and subtle issues in misclassification that merit a serious attention to those studying this association. Malcolm McClure gave us a nice framework for thinking about bias, and when we look at this association, secondhand smoke with lung cancer, confounding, information bias, the possibility that only positive studies were published have all been brought up, and again, not unreasonable. When Hirayama's study was published, there was a question as to whether there was a statistical error. Nathan Mantel was brought in as a consultant to the tobacco industry. And indeed, a problem was identified in the calculation of the test statistic, but with correction, the findings remained statistically significant. And research was carried out. This is a complicated story, and I will only say that here's the end result publication to address some of the subtleties of classification in this particular paper. So here's one paper with a number of interested stakeholders, the general public, public health, the tobacco industry, and others, of course, that went through the full gamut of criticism. Other concerns in this story have been to question whether we know about mechanisms, and of course biological plausibility is a critical component of our assessment of potential causality of associations. And here issues were raised around unknown mechanisms and whether there was in fact an animal model. Here, for example, is the mechanism argument. This is me being questioned in the Minnesota tobacco trial. Isn't it true that notwithstanding the amount that science may know about the P53 gene, that science cannot yet set out step by step, these three steps, I guess, the mechanism by which cigarette smoke causes lung cancer? And it was interesting today to hear Marcia Angel make a comment, in fact, to this point, that we still don't know the mechanism, which raises the question, when do we know a mechanism? And what are we talking about? And can that be a criticism inevitably raised in trying to pull out the biological plausibility support for associations observed in observational data? I suspect that decades from now, we will in fact know substantially more about the mechanism by which tobacco smoke causes lung cancer. We'll be defining it at new levels of molecular precision. Do we know the mechanism? Do we have support for plausibility? And of course comes the question, why do we need to know the mechanism? For those of you who can't see the bottom that says these studies are inconclusive, so far we've only succeeded in giving cancer and heart disease to laboratory humans. And with 1.1 billion smokers in our human laboratory now, do we need animals? The fine print over this is, what do you do when you run out of humans? Start using lawyers. Continuing down the scheme, their meta-analysis has been critical. The Environmental Protection Agency used meta-analysis in its 1992 risk assessment, and again, here, criticism surfaced on meta-analysis. Quantitative meta-analysis is a method for summarizing evidence. And again, you know, in terms of sort of spotting critics, when you see papers with titles like these, supported by a major stakeholder, you realize, of course, that they come with a possible point of view. Another way to attempt to set aside evidence is to propose alternative criteria for causality, to put together panels to also review the evidence. And this has also been done. There is a long history in use of epidemiological evidence to propose the fact that epidemiological evidence in combination with the other lines of evidence that we consider are not adequate for proving causation. And this is one of the arguments advanced in the case of both active and passive smoking for a long time. This quote comes from the lead attorney for the tobacco industry in the Engel case in Florida. Science has required three things in order to get to causation. First, statistics. I've taken that to the epidemiological studies. Second, animal studies, which follow up on hypotheses suggested by epidemiological studies. And third, understanding the mechanism. You can see this elegant definition of the mechanism, the thing that causes it. And apparently we don't quite yet have this thing. Now, what I'm trying to illustrate for you is some some of the tactics that are used. And now I'm going to suggest, when do you need to begin to think that your work, or work that you're looking at in some evidence synthesis process that may lead to policy, may invite critics. So I think epidemiologists doing studies that are relevant, which hopefully is most of the work, undoubtedly will be producing evidence that will be of interest to one or more stakeholder groups. So carrying out studies that are important, which I hope we all are, then there will be people who are interested. They may come from multiple points of view. And if your evidence is likely to be used in a policy-making process, is likely to be of great interest. And, you know, perhaps you are going to be, you know, study number 17 in a forest plot, but it's better than not making the forest plot at all, and you're making your contribution. There's also what has happened in the past, and I know if I publish in certain areas, that undoubtedly my work would be looked at by certain people, because they've been doing it for years. And I think, again, for those working in a particular field, you may come to know your sort of critics, if you will, who are working for stakeholder groups who are going to approach you and either tell you how much they like your work or possibly how stupid you are. This is also inevitable. And just as one example, in our work on air pollution, there's certain people we often hear from. One, for example, is Suresh Mangalkar, a useful critic, but someone who for the last 10 years our air pollution group has interacted with. And here's one of his comments in a recent paper related to a very important public health issue, the fine particle standard. So there's a range of people who will criticize, and I think that the people who I see in different policy-making settings range from very thoughtful critics and skeptics who keep us all honest to people who may come with a point of view, and if you want to call them fire guns, so be it. Some may have a track record of being spokespeople for stakeholders on a particular group, and some may not. And inevitably, the tactics follow some of the lines that I've showed you in terms of addressing whether studies are or are not informative. Now, what do we do to anticipate criticism? Well, we do good studies. And I think for those who are doing studies that are likely to be important in the policy realm, you need to be prepared to say that you've done a good study and to prove that you've done a good study. And increasingly, that means that you have well-documented QAQC protocols, you may have had an external review. If it's a particularly important study, you can produce a protocol. You've done a transparent analysis, and you've carried out relevant sensitivity and uncertainty analyses. And this may be very critical in assuring that the results are viewed as important and unbiased. For the problems of weak effects and some of the other methodologic problems, I also think we have things in the epidemiological toolbox. We need to do studies that are large enough, possibly to pool evidence, either at the individual level or carrying out a quantitative meta-analysis. We're in this new world where there's an expectation that we will share our data. In fact, on certain matters, for those of you familiar with the Shelby Amendment, you'll be aware that there may be a legal requirement that we share data if the evidence that we have comes from federally funded research and is disfigured